708 at Talk 107.3 FM, WBRP. Good morning, everybody. Brian Haldane here with you. Taylor Sharp producing. Thank you so much for joining us this morning. Got a lot of ground to cover this hour. A little bit more guest-heavy this hour. We talked to Shea Dixon in the first hour about recruiting, LSU recruiting to be specific. This hour, we're going to talk with Inspector General Stephen Street about Nate Kane's sentencing, which came down yesterday. We're also going to talk with Rodney Mallett from the Department of Transportation and Development about the Sunshine Bridge, what went down on Sunday, why they were able to determine so quickly that it was back up and running within in under 2 hours. It was shut down for 2 hours after being hit by a ship. So we'll talk with Rodney Mallett at 7:35. I expect the answers there to be pretty quick. We just want confirmation and a little more reassurance. Right now, though, we start every hour with top stories and trending.
Now, top stories and trending, keeping you informed on the stories people will be talking about today. Number five.
Top stories and trending, of course, brought to you by DaleBuysHousesNow.com. You can turn that ugly house, that unwanted house, into cash with DaleBuysHousesNow.com. Fire crews responded to a blaze at a truck warehouse on Sherwood Common Boulevard last night. The fire was reported around 9:15 p.m. at Capital Freightliner on Sherwood Common, which Sherwood Common runs between Airline and Corsi. According to the St. George Fire Department, firefighters arrived on the scene and found an 18-wheeler ablaze inside the garage. With help from the Baton Rouge Fire Department, the fire was contained in under 30 minutes. The structure of the warehouse sustained only minor damage. Luckily, no one was injured.
Number four.
Sheriff's deputies are looking for a person who potentially played a role in an ATV accident that killed a 61-year-old man over the weekend. Now, the crash happened around 3 p.m. Saturday near the McDonald's and Cash's truck stop on a road off of Highway 415. Authorities say the driver, identified as James D. Major Jr., was riding a three-wheeler down a private road that he used regularly. Deputies believe Major hit a pile of sand that caused his ATV to flip him. Video released by the sheriff's office Monday shows a semi-truck driver coming to a brief stop before seemingly dumping piles of sand on the roadway, then driving off again. Lieutenant Ken Alvarez, a traffic official with the West Baton Rouge Parish Sheriff's Office, says the man seen in the video is currently a person of interest in the deadly accident.
Number three.
Up to Angola, where a man serving two life sentences for murdering two women in the Lafayette area was denied appeals for both his convictions Monday. KATC out of Lafayette reports Brandon Laverne was denied appealability for his convictions in the murders of Lisa Pate and college student Mickey Schunick. Laverne claimed his sentence constituted cruel and unusual punishment due in part to his time spent in solitary confinement. He also alleged the court that convicted him shouldn't have had full jurisdiction over his case because elements of the crime happened in Lafayette Parish and his attorneys did a poor job advising him.
Number two.
Well, multiple witnesses told our news partners over at WBRZ that they watched in horror as a group of friends scattered after a 14-year-old they were with was shot on Father's Day. The shooting happened on St. Catherine Avenue near Hammond Drive in the Brookstown neighborhood. Neighbors told us when they heard the gunfire, they immediately thought fireworks were going off. One neighbor said he told his cousin, "No, those aren't gunshots," so they all ran inside. Another neighbor, Ray Kelly, saw what was unfolding, thought it would be a prime teaching moment, basically telling his kids, "Look, you see those kids running? Those aren't real friends. Your real friends would get you out of there."
Number one.
Down to Hammond, where a 15-year-old was killed and two more children were rushed to a Baton Rouge hospital after they were ejected from an SUV during a crash on I-55 late Father's Day. State police say the crash happened around 9:25 p.m. on I-55 South near Highway 51. Investigators say 38-year-old Viola Oliver was traveling southbound when she lost control of her vehicle, veered off the roadway. The crash caused the SUV to flip 4 to 5 times before coming to a rest upside down on a neighboring service road. Three children were inside the vehicle who were not wearing seatbelts at the time. They were all thrown from the vehicle. Police said 15-year-old Solomon Short died after being rushed to North Oaks Hospital in Hammond. The other two juveniles were airlifted to Our Lady of the Lake in Baton Rouge, where they remain in critical condition. That's a look at your top stories presented by DaleBuysHousesNow.com. You have an unwanted property? Check out DaleBuysHousesNow.com. And when I say property, I don't just mean house. I mean apartment complex. I mean commercial property. I mean a blighted property. DaleBuysHousesNow.com can help you out here. If you've got a fixer-upper that you just never got around to working on, DaleBuysHousesNow.com is your answer. Or give them a call at 291-8000. 291-8000 for DaleBuysHousesNow.com. Those are your top stories. Here's what's trending. Residents in Southeast Louisiana are reporting suspicious calls from an international phone number. Many have taken to social media to warn others of the apparent scam calls from a 676 number, often ID'd as coming from Tonga. Reports say answering the call will lead to an extra charge upwards of $100. Anyone who gets a call from such a number is advised not to answer it. You see a call from Tonga, unless you know someone in Tonga or know someone named Tonga, and the prefix is 676, don't answer it. We actually had somebody in the office the other day got a call from Tonga and a 676 number. Someone downstairs.
I don't know what I'm going to do. I got a lot of connections in Tonga.
You got friends
in
Tonga?
I'm not going to be able to answer any of them now.
Is that where you handle all your fantasy football and sports betting?
So I got all my offshore accounts.
See, the legislature could have solved this, and we could ignore Tonga if we could have just brought the betting home and not had to go through Tonga to get it done.
I'm done with fantasy football now.
Yeah, stay away from Tonga. 713 Stephen Street is next. Seven 17 to talk 107.3 FM WBRP. Brian Haldane here with you, and I'm joined in studio right now by Inspector General Stephen Street. Good morning. How are you, man?
Hello, Brian. How are you?
I'm doing good. Glad to have you on this morning. Obviously, it's never good circumstances to talk to the Inspector General, but I'm glad we can sit down and chat for a little while. Okay, so Nate Kane sentenced to over 3 years in prison. His wife sentenced to 8 months. Walk us through what happened along the way. Like, first of all, what did they do?
Okay, this is an investigation that began in 2016 by our office, and eventually we were joined by federal partners to bring this wire fraud prosecution that resulted in these sentences yesterday. And essentially what was going on, Brian, was they were using state credit cards, which are essentially called P cards. They're direct billed to state agencies, mm-hmm. and using those cards to essentially feather their own nests. And they did that for a period of years. And actually, there was a jury trial that took place back in March. And Nate Caden, of course, is the ex-warden of the Voiles Correctional Center, which is now the Raymond P. Laborde Correctional Center. But both Nate and his wife, Tanya, were using these cards at an incredible rate for personal purposes and personal mm-hmm. gain. And so during that jury trial, this is a bit unusual, the judge up there got to hear 3 days of detailed testimony about the type of things that they were buying with these cards. Now, the cards are designed to buy stuff for the prison, right? To
sure.
be used at the prison. And instead, they were buying things like a children's furniture. One of the particular exhibits that came in was a $400 children's pink princess chair. They bought dog food and supplies, toys for their pets, but listed them as canine purchases. Beats by Dre headphones, 7 pairs of those, all kinds of guns, gun parts and guns that were then turned around and sold for personal profit. Children's baseball gear, everything all the way down to detergent and toiletries. Girls' cowboy boots, children's shoes, Blu-ray players, TVs, bedding. Yeti coolers. I mean, you get the idea.
Yeah, just the accoutrements, the little creature comforts that we all love.
But we have to pay for ourselves.
Right, right. And so this might sound a little, they're going to prison for buying a Yeti cooler, but when you add it all up, it came to a pretty significant amount.
Yeah, you're talking about $152,000 worth of stuff that were purchased on the cards, and included amongst that, and I could still go on, having tires put on your personal car and then listing those very deceitfully as tires for a prison utility trailer. Furniture that's up in an attic with a sheet over the top of it, not even being used, those kinds of things. But one of the other major parts of the case was the building of a house on the prison grounds without proper approval, without proper authority, and using the P card to buy materials in $5,000 increments so that it would stay below the scrutiny of auditors. And the other thing that was really notable about the case, Brian, was the way that they went out of their way to conceal what they were doing from anybody who could challenge them. And one of the things they did was structure purchases to stay under the limits.
Like you just said about the purchases,
they would trigger
5,000.
The red flags, right? And so if they were going to go buy, you know, several $1,000s worth of stuff, they'd break it up into several different purchases to keep those dollar amounts below the limit.
What got the investigation started?
Well, we were, of course, the Inspector General gets information in all sorts of different ways. But we began looking at a lot of different aspects and noticed that there were some very unusual, and actually some of the folks within the Department of Corrections were very helpful in getting us started with this and said, hey, wait a minute, these are purchases that need to be looked at more closely. And so what happened was, as we basically audited all of those purchases and then went to try to find the items that were bought, and culminating in a search warrant that was done by our office at the home on the prison grounds back in 2016. And while there, we found quite a bit of the items that had been bought. Many of them were unaccounted for. And so there's a difference between the restitution amount. They were ordered to pay $42,000, but that's for the items that could not be accounted for. The total was over $152,000.
Building a home on prison grounds, just asking from a position of complete ignorance, is that normal?
Well, normally the warden is provided with a place to live on the prison grounds, and they actually did have a home on prison grounds. The thing is, though, that if you're going to build something like that, it's got to go through a process that's very detailed and laid out in the law. Right. Instead, what they did, because the money really wasn't there, they used P cards in order to just go completely around the system. To buy these materials and to start building this thing without going through any of the channels that you normally have to do.
Inspector General Stephen Street is our guest. We're talking about Nate Kane being sentenced to 38 months behind bars. His ex-wife, Tanya Bandy Kane, getting 8 months in prison, as well as they apparently worked together to defraud the state of over $150,000 through all this merchandise. So walk me through the investigation a little bit. So you guys get started. Did it just all come at once, or was this hard to crack?
We knew right away that there were some real problems. And so I call it all the time at the Inspector General, we're in the evidence business. We're a law enforcement agency that's dedicated to investigating fraud and public corruption. So we have to be very meticulous about going through records, about making sure that we do everything carefully, within the bounds of law and ethics. And then you just go start interviewing people. You start looking at records. You start actually using the law enforcement tools to help you put the case together. And one of the things that started to quickly develop was this culture of intimidation that had developed out at the prison. And keep in mind, a prison warden is pretty much the most powerful person within that realm. The warden is the king in the country.
Look, I think everybody would revert to Shawshank Redemption. That's what triggers in your head.
Yeah, those guys have great authority, and they're given great trust. And so with that, obviously, comes great responsibility. Well, here, obviously, some of these purchases are so out of bounds, and pretty much anybody would know it. Well, they had, and the reason we know this, that we heard the details of this, was that Warden Kane chose not to plead guilty until after 3 days of testimony before a criminal jury.
Right.
And so details came out. For instance, one DOC employee who questioned one of these purchases was taken outside, slammed up against a wall, and poked in the chest and told over and over again, "Loose lips sink ships. Don't you ever talk about our business," and essentially threatening the guy, "Don't you ever do that again." And there was another lady who testified to essentially the same thing, which when she asked questions, and it was like, "If you don't like it, you can catch the gate," which is get out of here, lose your job, go. Mm-hmm. And so that sort of culture of intimidation eventually developed to where these folks could do whatever they wanted.
Right. And just to be clear, when you're talking about intimidation, you're not just talking about intimidation of the prisoners. You're talking about the employees, the entire structure from top to
bottom.
Right,
right. And this was, the inmates were a whole separate issue here. This is the warden of the facility, and his wife was the prison business manager. So they were in a situation where they're using public funds to buy things that everyone else in the world has to buy for themselves.
Now, I got a couple questions for you that I don't know that you can answer, but I have to ask them.
I'll do my best.
Okay. First of all, the last name Kane pops up. He is the son of Burl Kane. Mm-hmm. And we're talking about, two guys that are wardens. Are prisons really set up to be the family business?
Well, that's a great question, and it's one. Let me just say this. The we would have investigated this case no matter what the last name of these individuals were, because it was a clear, blatant violation of the law. But it's, I'm glad you brought it up, Brian, because a lot of people, you know, who may not know the facts of a case like this think that, hey, we went after Nate Kane just because of his last name and because of the legacy and lineage of the Kane name inside the Department of Corrections. That's simply not true at all. Let me say this. Back in March of 2016, the Louisiana Inspector General issued a report clearing Burl Kane of criminal charges on some allegations out in Angola. Yeah. And anybody that wants to go back and Google that will realize the amount of hell that I caught in the public sector because of that. But as I said, we were in the evidence business. We took a look at it. We concluded that the evidence did not support criminal charges. We issued that report. This case came along totally different. The evidence was very, very clear. The United States Attorney's Office was very glad to take this case and to prosecute it. And as you can see, the results indicate that the evidence was, in fact, there.
Well, yeah, and I wouldn't suggest that y'all were going after him because of his name.
But others might.
My thought process is, we all know the old phrase, power corrupts, and absolute power corrupts absolutely. Mm-hmm. So when you have that much power based in one family, and like you said, when you set it up on the prison, the warden is just this side of God.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's take it outside the context of the Canes, and let's just talk about public corruption in general.
Yeah.
Because the fact is that in my business, we call it bulletproof and invisible. And when somebody stays in a business long enough and they stay in a position long enough, they eventually start to feel as though they are untouchable and can do anything, and the rules don't apply. The law doesn't apply. Because I've been here so long that I can just do this.
Right.
And 10 feet tall, bulletproof, and invisible. That's the way they – and so they make really foolish mistakes with the sort of stuff that they do. And it happens all over in any position. You know, Harry Truman once said it way back when. He said the only way to get rich in public service is to be a crook. And I think that was totally accurate then, and it's accurate now.
So – following along that, and this is another question you might not be able to answer, how pervasive is it? Like, where are we going next?
Well, with regard to the Department of Corrections, I was actually asked to testify in front of the Senate Judiciary C Committee back in April, and that committee has oversight of the Department of Corrections. And these two convictions were two of 10 different criminal cases that we successfully worked within corrections. Now, some of those had to do with guards beating handcuffed and shackled inmates. They were criminal civil rights cases.
Okay.
And then we had other forced resignations that occurred. But let me just say this. I'm convinced that a lot of this, the Department of Corrections has really gotten in gear to try to clean up their own act. And I've been very pleased to work with them and to see the changes that they've made. For instance, they've put some really tight restrictions now on the use of these P cards. And it's going to be difficult, if not impossible, for anybody inside DOC to do what the Canes did now, because they saw what happened. They addressed it, fixed the problem, and that's as Inspector General, that's what I want to see.
Sure,
that's what I want to see.
Yeah, it's not about just catching the crime or the criminal.
It's not about making sure
it doesn't happen.
It's not the gotcha business.
Right.
What we're trying to do, and of course, we think the sentences in this case were very appropriate. And by the way, 38 months in a federal penitentiary—that's no small thing for an ex-prison warden, and especially one with his lineage in the business.
Okay, so that was actually going to be my last question. We got 60 seconds left, so if you could answer it briefly. How does a prison warden go to prison? Like, do they have to be separated from everybody?
That's a question that's up to the Bureau of Prisons, but let me just say this. Warden Kane has no previous criminal history. I think it's highly likely he'll be sent to a minimum security sort of facility, and they will certainly take into account his background and his physical health and all of those kinds of things. That's always touchy when you have former law enforcement, former prison personnel that end up having to be put in prison themselves. And those guys are aware of those issues, and they try to address them up front.
Inspector General Stephen Street, thank you so much for the time this morning.
Brian, I'm glad to be here. Thanks.
Shed a lot of light on everything that went down over the last few days, or the last few years, as it were. Coming up on 7:31 at Talk 107.3 FM WBRP, we're going to check CBS News here in about 15 seconds. When we get back from our break, Rodney Mallett with Department of Transportation is going to give us the ins and outs of what went down with the Sunshine Bridge over the weekend, how they were able to reopen so quickly after being hit by a ship. Right now, though, here's CBS. We'll be right back. 7:37 at Talk 107.3 FM, WBRP. Good morning, everybody. Brian Haldane here with you. Taylor Sharp producing. You got us for another 23 minutes or so. So over the weekend, a ship hit the Sunshine Bridge, and it was closed down for an hour and 45 minutes. Now, most of us remember it was less than a year ago that a barge hit the Sunshine Bridge, and it was closed for, well, until January. So I wanted to bring in Rodney Mallett from the Department of Transportation to talk about what went on Sunday and what, you know, what they saw that allowed them to open things back up so quickly. Good morning, Rodney. How are you, man?
Good morning. Good talking to you. But one thing that you need to know is what happened last year and what happened Sunday are two very different occurrences. The crane that hit the bridge last year hit the substructure, and so it was unsafe for that bridge to be open. And we did everything we could to open up two lanes in each direction.
Right.
We completed the emergency repairs, and now what you see going on at the Sunshine Bridge is regular maintenance work that had been scheduled before the incident. But what happened on Sunday was a vessel hit the fender system that protects the piers, and the fender system did its job. Coast Guard, out of abundance of caution, called for state police, our partners over at state police, to close the bridge until it could be inspected.
Mm-hmm.
And it was a Sunday, and it was a Father's Day, but our inspectors grouped up, went down there, looked at that bridge, and we were able to determine that it was no real structural damage at all, and that we were able to open that bridge back up in less than 2 hours.
Okay, so the fender system did its job. Was there any determination that the ship actually made contact with the pilings itself? Or did it just bounce off of the wooden fencing structure?
You know, I really don't know. The Coast Guard would be the group that would be investigating that. But what our group did was go down there and just check the structure to make sure that it was structurally sound. And it was, and it still is. And just, you know, what we're going to be doing, I might want to throw this in, Thursday night.
Mm-hmm.
And we're going to have a survey crew and some other inspectors go out and just do a additional inspection on the pier just to make sure that there isn't any damage that can't come up long term. You know, we just want to make sure that everything's right in place.
Okay, so follow-up is on Thursday night. In the meanwhile, it's a green light. I had a number of emails yesterday asking, you know, an hour and 45 minutes. That seems remarkably quick. But, I mean, if that's all it takes, that's all it takes, Rodney.
Oh, yeah. You know, and the inspectors, they know what they're looking for. You'd be surprised. I think most of your listeners would be surprised how many times these bridges get struck. You know?
So that's actually a bigger point there, because this is twice that something's hit the Sunshine Bridge and it has made news. Is this something that happens and we just don't see?
Oh, yeah, certainly. You know, when it happens in the Coast Guard or investigates and it's nothing, they don't see anything, mm-hmm. then they sometimes they don't call it in, sometimes they do, and we'll go and look at it and there's nothing to it. You know, it all depends on the severity of the collision. And so the one that happened on Sunday, the Coast Guard responded quickly, as they always do, and determined that, out of abundance of caution, that they needed to shut down that bridge until our bridge inspectors could come down and get a good look at it.
Okay, so if anybody asks why the Sunshine Bridge, like, is it cursed or the pilings too close together or anything like that, it's not just a matter of why the Sunshine Bridge. This happens with all bridges.
Oh, yeah, yes. We've had it happen not too long ago with the I-20 Vicksburg Bridge, and we went and inspected that and found that there was no structural damage. Was able to keep that bridge open as well. And then even some of the smaller ones, you might not remember. And there was a bridge over in Rose Tate that got wiped out. And so we had to rebuild that whole bridge.
Oh, goodness.
Yeah, see, it wasn't a big bridge like the one that's across the Sunshine, not across the Mississippi River, but it was still a bridge that took on some damage, and we had to rebuild that bridge. And that took a while.
I would imagine the question of why the ship hit the bridge in the first place is probably not for you. That's probably for somebody who has a more of a nautical background and not a DOTD background.
Right, that's going to be your Coast Guard.
They're that would be the next phone call, sure.
Yeah, they're the ones who are in charge of everything on the water.
Yeah. Well, Rodney, go ahead.
We worked real close with those guys, and with state police when these incidents occur,
mm-hmm.
because, you know, safety is our number one goal. We don't want people to be inconvenienced, for sure, but would much rather people be angry because they're inconvenienced than be angry because something terrible happened, you know?
Yeah, and hey, that's why we're talking to you this morning. We would much rather have the reassurance that an hour and 45 minutes is all that it actually takes versus, nah, they just said it looks good and threw it back open again. So I appreciate the reassurance this morning, Rodney.
Anytime you need anything, just give me a call. You know how to reach me.
Yes, sir. Let me know if anything pops up Thursday night. Thanks, man.
All right. Bye.
Rodney Mallett with Department of Transportation and Development. We all saw what happened Thursday. Or not Thursday. We all saw what happened Sunday. They've got the follow-up on Thursday. 743 at Talk 107.3 FM WBRP. Want to shift gears to talk about a different story here, and that is I don't know if you saw this one or not. The head of the State Troopers Association was arrested after firing a gun at the office during a family feud. Actually, WBRZ has the full story here. Let's go ahead and hear it from them.
Out of jail. Tonight, he's accused of shooting his gun yesterday during a family tiff.
David Young, the executive director, arrested last night at the association's headquarters in Baton Rouge on Jefferson Highway. That's where News 2's Mark Armstrong is live right now with this wild story. Mark.
Michael, Sylvia, yes, this association representing the majority of state police here in Louisiana. Its executive director tonight is accused of holding a gun to his daughter's boyfriend and even shooting above his head. Take a look.
The incident happened just after 4 in the afternoon Sunday in the parking lot of the State Trooper Association. East Baton Rouge deputies say video not yet released to News 2 shows Young pointing a gun at his daughter's 37-year-old boyfriend who was sitting on the ground before taking off running. Deputies say Young then fired a shot just above the boyfriend's head. The association on Jefferson Highway sits in an upscale part of Baton Rouge with several apartment complexes and a park right next door. Young's 35-year-old daughter told deputies her father does not like her boyfriend because he does not take care of the couple's child. He became upset when he found out the boyfriend was at the association. Young is the executive director of the Louisiana Trooper Association, which advocates for state police and retirees. He has been charged with aggravated assault with a firearm, illegal use of a weapon, and false imprisonment.
And in a statement tonight from the association, they called this incident yesterday unfortunate and went on to say that along with Young being arrested, so was the daughter and the boyfriend.
All three were arrested. That's weird. It's an unusual incident, to say the least, raising a number of different questions, not the least of which being they were at the office on Father's Day? Anyway.
Well, that's why he was mad.
Exactly. Exactly. I'm sure that played into it. I'm curious to see where this one goes, though, because as the head of the State Troopers Association, this is clearly going to make the news every time it, like, pops up. Like, every step along the way in the legal process, this is going to pop back up in front of us over something that probably otherwise, if it weren't for who he is, probably wouldn't be coming up every single time around. But our thanks to WBRZ for carrying that story. For us to play back for you here. Got one more I want to touch on before we have to hit your money now, and that is Restore. Checks are on the way. Duplication of benefits is a thing of the past, or so we're told. Louisiana officials are optimistic that the 2016 flood victims who did not get Restore grant money due to receiving SBA loans will be seeing a check in the very near future. State Office of Community Development Executive Director Pat Forbes says the state is getting final guidelines approved by HUB. After that happens, they'll be contacting remaining flood victims. Now, every time that we've talked to Garrett Graves on this show within, like, I don't know how long, but there's always a question in the app about, ask him about duplication of benefits, ask him why I haven't seen a Restore check, ask him about being stuck with the SBA loan. Same thing with Senator Cassidy. Both of those guys get this question every single time they're out. Quote, we will be reaching out to individuals about what their specific next steps are once we've got the clarifications from HUD, this according to Pat Forbes. This action should end the duplication of benefits loophole. All households below 120% of the area median income that they live in will be cleared to receive their check shortly. Forbes says if you make over that amount, HUD will have to take a closer look at your need for the funds. Quote, over 120%, we're going to have to, as a state, demonstrate to HUD a hardship on a case-by-case basis. Forbes says the state is writing guidelines that must be approved by HUD for the hardship waivers in a way that will hopefully allow most families above that 120% level to still receive their checks. But the good thing about this is, like, the duplication of benefits loophole is all but gone. I mean, unless you're making more than 120%, then you've still got a hurdle to clear. But for the vast majority of it, majority of us, I should say, if you make less than 20% higher than the average median income, you're good to go. So we should start to see checks very soon. This is going to help out a lot of folks, a lot of folks who are still reeling after a flood that was 3 years ago. A flood that was 3 years ago. Forbes says for the most part there will be very little, if anything, that most Restore applicants will need to do other than just wait a little while longer. No problem there. Been waiting for 3 years. Just glad to hear some movement here. Quote, we don't anticipate it being months or the end of the year or anything like that. We're expecting to understand this as much as we need to very shortly. I'll be looking for my check, I'll tell you that. I hope this finally puts a button, a book, just closes the book on the 2016 flood. All households below 120%. So you're talking about, like, median income is the middle. So roughly 50% are already below it. This is going to help out a lot of people that are still reeling. That's good to know. I'm going to follow up on that conversation with Garrett Graves a little bit tomorrow when we talk with Congressman Graves. And, of course, the next time we have Senator Cassidy on, I know this has been front and center. This has been every day waking up to this one for him. So next time we talk with Senator Cassidy, probably let him take a little bit of a victory lap as well. All right, coming up on 750 at Talk 107.3 FM, we've got one segment to go here before handing you off to Brian Kilmeade. We do have to check on money in markets. We got to check on Wall Street. Here's your money now. .756 at Talk 107.3 FM WBRP. Brian Haldane here with you for one more segment before we hand things off to Brian Kilmeade of Fox News Talk. You got Brian Kilmeade from 8 to 11. Of course, Todd Starnes from 11 to 1, and then Dave Ramsey from 1 to 4. Oh, hey, the Bandito Food and Music Festival is a little bit country, a little bit rock and roll, a little bit south of the border, and a little bit Americana. This unique culinary and music festival will be held in downtown Baton Rouge this weekend. Brings the best combination of barbecue and tacos with a South Louisiana flair. Live music includes statesmen of the alt-country genre Sunvolt, Old 97s, the Bottle Rockets, and Shooter Jennings, as well as local acts The Grinders and The Hitchhiker. I talked to the guy from The Hitchhiker last week. The benefactor for this festival will be Behind the Line, a Baton Rouge nonprofit 501c3 organization that seeks to make a difference in the lives of first responders and their families. Bandito Music Festival downtown June 22nd from 11 a.m. to 11 p.m. presented by the Williamson Eye Center. I got just a couple minutes left before we get out of here. I did want to touch on one other story that finally crossed the governor's desk. No more veggie bacon. Yeah, Governor John Bel Edwards has made it official. Veggie bacon, broccoli rice, or cauliflower rice, other veggie foods will need new names to stay on Louisiana's grocery store shelves next year. Governor John Bel Edwards' office announced yesterday the Democratic governor has signed new food labeling restrictions into law. I like the fact that the story told us he's a Democratic governor because this is one that's going to divide us on party lines, right? The law will keep veggie products from being called meat, non-rice products from being described as rice and sugar alternatives from being marketed as sugar. The restrictions begin October of 2020. Louisiana's Ag Commissioner will enforce the law with civil penalties up to $500 per day for violations. I wonder, you know what? I need to find out who they're going to find. Do they find the manufacturer or do they find the local grocer who puts the product on the shelf? Supporters say they're protecting Louisiana's ag industry and ensuring consumers know what they're buying. Opponents say the law will lessen the availability of some veggie products for Louisiana consumers. Six other states have passed similar food labeling restrictions. God, I love when Louisiana wants to be the front runner in something. You know, 15 other states have legalized sports betting. Yeah, I'm not down with that. The number of states legalizing weed is growing day by day for recreational use. Not really down with that. What about a veggie burger? Damn it! We got to stop this. Stop this madness. Stop this insanity. Veggie burgers we will not tolerate. things that would be revenue drivers for the state. Whatever you want. Cauliflower rice. Does anybody really buy cauliflower rice and they're surprised when it's not actually rice?
Does anybody take a bite and they're like, I thought they were just kidding?
Right. Like, this doesn't taste like rice at all. It tastes like cauliflower. Yeah, it's cauliflower. This veggie burger doesn't taste like meat. Well, it did say veggie burger. I could sit here for 4 hours breaking down the minutiae of what things could be called. That would be fun. Like, let's break down a veggie burger. It says veggie in the title. Cauliflower rice. It says cauliflower in the title. You're choosing to pay attention to the wrong word. All right, CBS News is next. I'm out of here.